You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
Just a quick correction to something in the podcast that you're about to hear with Kat Rose, which is very exciting and was a good time. I mentioned Frater Acker's book, Holy Diamond, and it turns out you can get it as an ebook for $10. So, ignore what I said. I was, in general, more talking about books that you can't get similar to that. So, enjoy the podcast with Kat Rose, Discovering Your Personal Diamond.
So, are you in England? Yes, you are.
Yes. Yeah. About an hour south of London, place by the sea. Yes.
Whereabouts?
Brighton. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of
I've watched Pride and Prejudice.
I feel like a lot of Americans know a lot more about the UK than I do. I remember I was visiting a friend's family over there, and they got me into Downton Abbey, and I'd never watched it before. I was like, oh,
really?
Yeah.
You'd never seen Downton Abbey, but
yeah, I mean, it didn't interest me until I was
convinced
by people from the outside world.
That's funny that that Americans would be more into it than Brits, but cool. Yeah, I actually have some suitcases in Rochester that I left there the other year.
Okay.
I just had too much stuff, so I just left it at my buddy's place. Rochester's sort of that neck of the woods, isn't it? Near Brighton, that area, sort of.
The embarrassing thing is, as small as England is, I actually don't know quite where that is. So
really?
I've heard of it, of course, but
because it's so east, I guess. Yeah. And you're southwest.
I'm southeast, actually. Yeah.
I was doing some guest lectures at the University of Kent.
Yes, Kent. Of course.
Yeah. Really, really nice place, Canterbury. I hadn't been there before.
It is. Yeah. There's like the castle walls or some kind of city walls there. They're quite nice.
Yeah. And the cathedral and everything. Yeah. Well, welcome to Magic Without Fears, the podcast.
Yes. And,
How did you hear about me?
I listen to so many different podcasts that I end up kind of forgetting how I found them in the first place. So I wish I had a good story for that, but I just really loved the title. I thought because it's like a reference to Crowley.
Oh yeah, I guess it sort of is. See, I still have my headset plugged into my computer, even, and I'm wearing it as if it's plugged into you, but it's not. So let me just do that. There we go. My voice might turn out better on the recording since I'm doing this on my phone because my computer just keeps crashing.
I restarted, it crashed again. Yeah, it's sort of a Crowley reference, I guess, isn't it? That's the idea. That was sort of the idea. I didn't really like the name, but it seemed, it felt right for some reason, and I couldn't find it having been used much elsewhere. And so I thought, well, hell, it was the beginning of the pandemic is when I started it.
Only that recently. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had podcasts before, but they kept like locking me out of them.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I find sometimes companies just sort of lock you out of things, especially occult stuff. They just decide to, like, you know, which is frustrating though, because it means they keep getting revenue from your content, but you can't even remove it.
Yeah.
I have several podcasts up online that are still like that, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You can't just keep, you can't publish to that RSS feed is kind of like.
No, they just blocked me and decided that they weren't mine anymore. Yeah, it's an odd thing. I know you'd think that wouldn't be possible, but it is. Yeah.
The powers that be. I
think there's a lot of power to sort of ignorance. Like, they just sort of act like they don't know what they're talking about or what's going on. Like, wait, what? Oh, I don't know. Oh, well, sorry. Goodbye. And if you really pursue it, you just keep hitting more and more walls of confusion and lack of clarity. And you have to repeat yourself over and over. And that's sort of, I think, the new totalitarianism is really just incompetence.
Yeah, right. It's the grinding us down through incompetence. That's the biggest
one. There's no evil masterminds or plot. It's just incompetence. Just people have had enough. We're done.
Yeah, that's it. Have you explored any of those other like platforms, things like Odyssey and other ones?
Odyssey, no. I've heard of that. And I know the Canadian company is big, Rumble.
Okay.
That's pretty big and growing, but no, you know, I tend to I guess I generally find I don't have too much time to master all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a book coming out, so you must be concerned with presenting things across all those platforms. But it's a delicate balance I find between doing that stuff and not letting your attention be drawn out of the research and writing and all of that.
Like the real creative work completely.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time, cause I've been like freelance for about just under 10 years. And then I've had a podcast since 2016. It's kind of mutated over the years, but I've spent far too much time in the past fretting about different platforms and how to best get stuff out there. And at the more I've seemed to in the last like couple of years just focus on doing good work, actually the better the work is and the right people find it. And I think that's more important to me, the right people finding this stuff. So
yeah, well that's the true essence of what marketing should be, right? That's the idea. Of if you're a really good marketer, it doesn't mean you can sell ice to an Eskimo. It means you help people get what they actually want.
Who are actually looking for ice actually find you.
It was something I heard a long time ago when I was first in a band, and it was another older musician talking about congruency, and it really clicked with me in a big way, and I'm glad that I heard that, because at first, you know, when you're in a band, you're just trying to get attention however you can. But then I realized, you know, the more authentically we represent where we're actually at and what we're actually doing, the more we'll attract people that actually are interested in what we really want to do, rather than who are just drawn in by the big flashy sign that says, you know, something dramatic.
For free drinks if you come. Yeah, well, it's interesting you kind of that we got onto this, because it does make me think of the daimon and how that it's not just the workings of, you know, good marketing. It's something happens when we do work that feels authentic to us and that we know is our best, most true work. And I think that's something a little bit more like magical. And for me, that's the daimon. But
yeah, let's talk about that. That's it's very cool that you're on to that subject. How did you get into that?
I think it was probably a podcast that I'd listened to about 2-3 years ago, which was on an astrological technique that is meant to find basically the strongest planet in your chart. And one of the things that the hosts at the start were saying was that a Neoplatonist, Porphyry, said that this could be used as a technique to locate the personal daimon in a birth chart. And there was some disagreement about this, and this is something that I've been kind of like losing sleep over. It's like, yeah, but Iamblichus didn't think you could use astrology to find the personal daimon, and having to kind of grapple with that myself. But astrology basically was my way into looking into the daimon. I read a really wonderful book called The Daimon in Hellenistic Astrology, which I do recommend, but it's a tome, and it's very academic and technical. And for me, it's kind of easy to get into the daimon from that left brain approach and do the kind of, which astrology can be. It can be very, all right, let me just like run the numbers and boom, you have the planet. Now go and deal with it. For me, it was then a case of, okay, I've done that kind of the heady research about the daimon. Now, how do I live with the daimon? And that process is kind of what I was trying to figure out while simultaneously trying to write the book about it.
Yeah. So is your background in astrology or classics, or it sounds like you're mixing the two quite a bit.
Yeah, no, and I have no formal training in either of those things. No, astrology I found, again, not that recently. So, sorry, not that long ago. It was pretty recently, about 3 years ago. My background was more in like pop psychology, being interested in like personality typing tests, learning about the Myers-Briggs test. This is like several years ago, and getting a lot of benefit just personally from understanding these terms, and kind of, you know, lenses to see ourselves. Basically, I was pretty skeptical about astrology, and I kind of accidentally borrowed a book from the library which had a bit of astrology in it. Had a conversation with one of my most skeptical friends, and I was like, "Oh, come on, yeah. I mean, astrology, hey, like, how crazy is that? Do people really believe this stuff?" And she was like, "Yeah, but you know that your Myers-Briggs stuff isn't scientific, really, either." I was like, yeah. Oh, so, but instead of being put off the Myers-Briggs thing, I was like, well, if that's useful and that's not scientific, then maybe
it was such a horrible day. I was so sad the day I found out that it was all a bunch of BS. Yeah. I'm a proud INTJ, and the INTJ write-up describes me to a T. I actually blue tacked one of my old rehearsal room wall in our place for the band house, because I was like, look, people may as well just know what they're getting into right now. I was like, that's so accurate to me. Just, yeah. I seriously would rather people read that before they talk to me. Like, okay, nice to meet you. Here's a piece of paper.
and it's shorthand, which then helps people, because especially like for other people who already know that language. And this is very similar to astrology on a very superficial level. Astrology can be that. It can be a way for us to kind of shorthand a lot of the stuff about ourselves, and discuss it with each other. So anyway,
for sure,
with that,
for sure. Gave me that, I actually like that idea that you just said of astrology playing a role in our sort of lives as a potential for a shorthand. Yeah. Descriptors, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, often when someone says, well, I'm a this or a that, they often know that they're not reduced to that single quality, but they're trying to tell you something by saying that right then and there. Mm-hmm. Right. And we should listen for that rather than just think they're being flakes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, completely. So yeah, I was getting into astrology from that perspective, very personality driven. And then I found the more traditional side of things and realized that, okay, this isn't just a personality typing tool. It can be used to predict things. It can be used to help me understand my past. And similarly, like the daimon for me is kind of like inextricable from my understanding of astrology. And it's helped me kind of grapple with some of those questions of astrology, which, you know, what does it mean to have everything predestined, and how much does free will play into that. What would free will even be? If it's real, then what is it? And this is exactly what the ancient people who were talking about the daimon and working with astrology, you know, nearly 2,000 years ago, that's exactly the kind of questions that they were asking as well.
What have you discovered in your research about the astrological connection with the diamond or?
Yeah. So the only kind of like, so you probably know that there are houses in astrology and the 12 houses all relate to different life areas or topics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. My mom's an astrologer actually, has been her whole life. And I used to teach it in the Golden Dawn, so I'm fairly familiar, but not by any means an expert or a master of any kind. Just know what I need to know. So yes, I have that common language, though. You can assume that I know all the terms and everything and significances.
And just in case some people in your audience might,
do explain for them for sure. Yeah,
and so there was in traditional Hellenistic astrology, the different houses had names. So the first house is called the Helm. The fifth house was the house of good fortune. Well, the 11th house was the house of good daimon or good spirit. Those names, spirit and daimon, could be used interchangeably. And the 12th house is the house of bad daimon or bad spirit. And that I already knew that kind of before I really did a lot of research into the daimon. But when I was being taught it, it was kind of like, well, the 11th house, it's about groups and benefactors and people who like lift you up in the world. And, it's kind of like somebody who puts in a good word for you to the boss and you get a promotion. That's the 11th house. And 12th house experiences are like the dark nights of the soul, the unconscious material that, you know, we self-sabotage ourselves. But I hadn't really ever thought, all right, what is that spirit? What is that daimon that these refer to? Now, while I don't think that these describe, you know, very specifically our personal daimons, I do think that those houses can really speak to experiences and encounters that we have with people that are daimonic in nature. And what I mean by that is that those kind of experiences that we have, like let's say we have an 11th house transit, something happens, we meet somebody who just really helps us out in some way. I think those experiences are the things that kind of push us or like guide us onto what I'm calling like our path or our destiny. And 12th house experiences, I think, do the same thing. They just do it in a less pleasing way and a way that we might feel is subjectively very difficult. So that would be one lens to see at least daimonic experiences as in destiny related experiences in our birth charts. Does that make sense?
And so it's the Helm, the 12th house is called in Hellenistic astrology.
That was the first house.
First house. What's the 12th house called in there?
That was the house of bad daimon. Bad daimon.
Bad, really?
Malas daimon.
Really? Huh.
Well, yeah.
What is the daimon in sort of Western terms? Are we talking about something similar to the nativity angel? Or how are you using it in terms that might be understandable to someone in the Western mystery tradition or Western spirituality who doesn't know Greek?
That's a good point. And this is where, I spend about half the book trying to figure that out. And
oh yeah.
Okay. There are just because there are lots of different ways you can see it. And like for me, I grew up, I was raised Catholic and I was told that I had a holy guardian angel watching over me and protecting me. And in some ways that has been a likened to the daimon. I personally don't see the daimon per se as a like totally angelic or protective force. I think it's much more aligned with destiny. And in fact, like literally just the other day, I was reading a copy of Plato's Republic where he talks about the daimon gets mentioned basically at the end of the Republic in the story, The Myth of Ur. And it's basically a story of a man who died on a battlefield, goes and sees kind of the inner workings of like the heavens and how all the souls choose their lives before kind of going back down to Earth or going to Earth for the first time. And they also get assigned a daimon. And I'd heard this story and I reference it in the book, but I hadn't seen this particular copy, this particular translation of the Republic. And in it, the translator takes daimon, which it would have been written because daimon's a Greek word, and replaces it with the word destiny. I was like flicking through it. I was like, why I can't see the word daimon. Oh my God, he's actually just replaced daimon with destiny. And that's crazy because that's kind of the big point I'm trying to make in the book, which is overall, we could just use daimon and destiny. It's the same thing. It's just that the daimon is a helpful way for us to kind of paint a face on our destiny and actually have a kind of personal relationship with it. So yeah, but I say that destiny can feel very impersonal and we can get it confused with the kind of crap that happens to us. And that doesn't always feel very good. But I actually do find it quite helpful to like fully personify that. And my daimon is like a fox-headed fawn type being. So, you know, hopefully that messy description gives you some ideas of what I'm trying to play with when I think about the daimon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it was, of course, a word Yeats famously used in his magical motto, W.B. Yeats. Everyone loves him, right? Good. Of course, back then, their Greek wasn't as good as ours, obviously. Not that ours is, mine's not very good. But so he was, his nickname was Demon because they didn't really, he misspelled it, I guess you could say, a little as Damon, doing the AE spelling, which I think
that's just a Romanized way.
It's a Romanized, yeah. So their Greek wasn't as good. They were better at Latin, right? And that became Demon. And then he was just nicknamed Demon, which led to, in our century, really people thinking that his motto was Demon. Deus in versus the devil is, I'm confused. That's what his motto was. Demon est Deus in versus. I flipped it around in my head. People thought he meant Daimon, but he didn't. Yeah, he meant really the devil. That's it. It's still early for me here over in Canada. Sorry. Forgive me as I drink my coffee. And
I'm just glad you brought up that because that was actually one of the things that really delighted me because I'd read like a biography of Yeats a while ago. And I read about this character, Leo Africanus, which was basically, as I understand, like Yeats' understanding of the daimon or his.
He plays with that a lot, especially in the vision theory and all of that. And
I want to say that because that was an interesting thing, because I think Leo Africanus was like a historical character. And I think I left it out of the book, but part of my research was, you know, could your daimon show up as like a figure from history? And I just think that's an interesting thing to play with. And Yeats was sort of one of my examples of that. But I think later Yeats is a great person to explore for trying to wrap your head around the daimon if you're ready to kind of go into his world. That was something that I haven't gone too deep into in the book, but I do mention him a little bit.
Yeah. Also, he was a Gemini, so that makes it extra fun, trying to figure out what he actually meant. My best friend growing up was Gemini, and I was also once upon a time married to a Gemini, and I learned quite intimately that what they actually believe can be quite different from what I mean when I say I actually believe something as an Aquarius. Gemini's a bit more mutable,
just a little bit.
As proof by the fact that I'm no longer married. right. Blame it on the Gemini.
Mm. Poor Geminis, they get such a bad rap.
they totally do, and they deserve it. What's your sign?
I'm a Cancer rising, sun in Aries, moon in Sag.
Oh, lovely. I have my moon in Sag. That's a fun one, right?
That's why you've got issues with Gemini.
Is it?
Well, no, I think
and it's
there's
in
a funny,
the second house too.
I think where Gemini is really easy to like play with ideas, Sag, especially Sag moon, we can get quite upset when like people aren't taking an idea seriously enough. But I don't know, it's still a mutable moon. So
I'm in touch with what you just described there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Yeats, Yeats wasn't, it was mistaken as Diamond, but it was actually Demon. He meant it that way because it was from a Blavatsky thing and a line that was very popular at the time. But the idea of the diamond in today, and it's the word's coming back, which is interesting to see the word coming back. People are replacing it for a couple different things. People are using it to replace for familiar spirits and spiritual guides. Yep. And people are using it to replace for angels, and also even, of course, actual demons, if you get into this, what some of the goetic magicians are up to, and, you know, calling different things diamonds, because there are a lot of diamonds. I mean, what I was told in, I think, early high school or college was that everything had a diamond in an animistic sense, and there was a diamond for the salt shaker and a diamond for the all these things. And I don't know if that was true, but that was what we were told. But mostly I'm more familiar with the role of the diamond as a kind of a stand-in for the holy guardian angel or the holy angel that often gets in, or these days there's a debate about the confusion between that and the nativity angel. And it sounds like the nativity angel is something that's tied to astrology, and the holy angel is something that transcends astrology in the context of the Western mystery tradition.
Yeah.
What do you think about all that?
That was something that I've kind of had to grapple with more recently myself. When I was researching the book, and this is the astrology piece is very much based on, like I said, Dorian Greenbaum's book, The Diamond and Hellenistic Astrology. But while I think that's a fantastic book from the astrological perspective, and also she has a great understanding of like the Neoplatonists and what they were saying, it's not like she goes really deep into like theurgy and really goes into what Iamblichus was trying to say. And as far as I know, and certainly not into what like Agrippa was saying later in history. So that idea of the nativity angel versus like the personal god in Daimon, who's kind of like maybe on a higher level, that isn't addressed in the book. So I only came across those concepts like really recently. I was talking to Jeffrey Kufferman, who wrote Living Theurgy, and I was like, oh, I kind of need to like rethink some things. I'm not willing at the moment to see a real difference between this nativity daimon, like the one that's connected to my birth chart, and my personal daimon. To me, it's like, it's all the same.
I'd say it would still be a personal daimon, right?
Yeah. But this idea that you couldn't possibly know the personal daimon through looking at your birth chart, the way I see it, our birth chart is descriptive of, let's say it's descriptive of our soul's path. Well, even if it's not, and I'm not saying that you can take one planet and like that is your daimon. Like no one, like my daimon isn't Mars, it's not Saturn, it's not Jupiter. But let's say there's a strongest planet in our chart that could, I don't know, somehow encompass the overall, you know, essence of the path that our soul is meant to be on. Well, surely that is the daimon is most concerned with that. That's the daimon's job. So I don't know. I end up just tying my brain in knots, basically, when I get into that stuff. Ultimately, the point of the book was to explore the concept of the daimon. And if somebody wants to say the daimon is like a witch's familiar, I'm down with that. Like that's totally fine. I think if you look really hard at the daimon, it does defy being pinned down to one definition. It's a kind of a liminal being. It's not good, it's not evil. It's, you know, it's not this or not, it's not that. And I'm happy with it being that mutable, I guess. It's probably like really unsatisfying to a lot of people. It's like, yeah, but come on, let's define it. Let's have one definition.
I'm with you. I dig the exploration and sort of the ideas. I mean, everything between the different theories there are out there of diamonds and spirits and angels and guardian angels and nativity angels and spirit guides, like it's all very, very interesting. All the theory is very interesting. And I mean, in general, I've always felt that theory is meant to help us with our lives in practice and living, right? So if it does, wonderful. If it doesn't, then, you know, move on. And, you know, I had my mom took me to a psychic when I was 13, or took me to many psychics when I was a kid. But one in particular got me in touch with a couple spirits that were very, it was a profound experience. And I worked with them for years, one of them was clearly sort of angelic, you know, definitely, you know, the old Testament biblical angel mm-hmm. type character, maybe. Really did a lot of work with that spirit throughout high school, got me through some rough times in mm-hmm. grade 9, 10, that sort of thing. Or 8, 9, 10. The other spirit was definitely more a part of myself. And I could tell that. That was mm-hmm. what was very interesting. So this psychic, who was quite a famous one to the stars and all that noise, but she was good. And you have to be good. Otherwise, you know, people aren't going to keep paying you crazy money, right? Like, real, let's face it, there has to be some results. Otherwise, they are nuts. And so she was good. She was really, really good. In fact, I wish I still had the cassette tape she recorded from the mm-hmm. sessions, because I'd like to... Everything I thought that would never be true that she said turned out to came true, including me making masks of all things, which when she said, I'm like, oh, well, not all psychics can be that perfect. Right. You yeah. know, it's like, as a kid, I was like, woman, I'm never making masks. Trust me. I think that's the stupidest thing. She's like, I see you making a lot of masks. Then all of a sudden in grade 11, I decided that the school wasn't putting on enough plays. So I gathered all the cool kids together after class, gave them some scripts. We started rehearsing plays that I was directing and producing with my buddy. And they were all a bunch of Yates plays. And so right before we went into stage production, next thing I knew, I realized, and I remembered that what she said, but I hadn't remembered it till then, when I was sitting there putting plaster of Paris on someone's face and making like mm-hmm. 10 masks, because Yates has masks in most yes. of his plays. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah. And I was like, that's crazy. And I was getting really into it, but I had forgotten what she even said. Did mm-hmm. she plant that in me and cause it to happen? I don't think so. I don't yeah. think that her saying that somehow planted the seed that led to me therefore making masks one day. I think she saw me making masks, a lot mm-hmm. of masks. She had a glimpse of it. I was like, oh, for some reason you're going to make a bunch of masks. And I've been obsessed with making masks ever since. They're used in Golden Dawn rituals. They're used in Yeats plays and... Mm-hmm. Hey, who doesn't enjoy Halloween?
Exactly. And it does make you ask the questions like the problem with time, because time is the thing that's kind of making this so much more of a mystery. So when somebody's getting like a snapshot of you making masks, that actually does make sense in the grand sense of like scheme of things. But because we're dealing with this annoying concept of time, it seems like a big mystery to us from our perspective. So similarly, like when I'm thinking about the diamond, I really am thinking very much about, again, coming back to this concept of destiny, the fact that you were always meant to be making those masks, and who knows, like maybe there'll continue to be a mask story, you know, throughout your life. And so this is why, like, just one of the concepts of the diamond that isn't that helpful for me is when I think about it as just a purely protective force. So even though I love the concept of the kind of protective spirit, like I had when I was a kid, I think we have that. I do think like I have a guardian angel. I don't think that's my daimon though. You know, I don't think that the daimon is that interested in protecting me. It's interested in getting me to fulfill my destiny. So as I said that, I felt like I sound a bit crazy? Is that like, you know, and you just have these moments and
no, I think that puts you even in more in the sort of the occult sphere, and in good company with the magicians who, are approaching the holy guardian angel and guardian angel spirits from a non-Judeo-Christian perspective, mm-hmm. which more and more people want to be able to do that. They want to be able to, connect with spirits and or their different layers of their selves, higher souls, without being burdened by that language. Because so many get burdened down by either Christian or Kabbalistic language in our mm-hmm. culture. And a lot of people just have had enough of that. I was raised in a Maharishi Hindu meditating family. Mm-hmm. So when I discovered Christianity in my teens, I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, novelty.
screw that yogic noise that I had grown up with. I was bored of the Bhagavad Gita and mandatory meditation times twice a day. I thought Christianity was very cool. You know, I watched The Last Temptation with his name?
Not Mel Gibson.
No, that one, the church liked The Last Temptation of Christ. Right. They blacklisted Willem Dafoe and Harvey Keitel as Judas. What are you doing, man? What are you doing? Like these yanks. It was great. I thought it was an amazing thing. And I was going through certain things in the Golden Dawn at that time that really lined up with that sort of transformative experience. It was good. So I'm comfortable with that language now, but a lot of people aren't. And that's why I'm very interested in the diamond stuff coming out. And it's being embraced by sort of right and left-hand path people. I mean, you'll see it being as embraced by sort of hermetic Christians and like me, and also pagans. But then you also have like hardcore left-hand path people and Satanists who are also embracing it. And so if the language allows people to maybe achieve their destinies, then who's anyone to get in the way?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I wouldn't want it to be this kind of, oh, well, the diamond told me to do it, so you know, it's this an excuse to do certain things. But I've kind of always thought about that problem that we run into as soon as we start naming something or like diagnosing something. Would you, for example, even with let's say the INTJ thing. So we both identify as INTJs. Well, that can be an excuse for me to like, just like not talk to people and okay, I don't do small talk. So, you know, and that's not always helpful in different situations in life. So while I don't want to make anything an excuse for bad behavior, I do think the daimon is generally a very helpful concept. It's certainly been helpful for me anyway. Especially when it comes to just like, yeah, grappling with that big question of like, why am I doing this? Is this just a random, you know, even the study of astrology and looking at our birth charts, it can feel like a bit of a, okay, I just happened to be born at this time. Where's the meaning in that? Somehow, the more I've dug into the daimon stuff and what the ancient, I'm going to say Greeks, but you know, Hellenistic peoples were kind of talking about, I think it brings back the meaning into that idea of predestiny.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
While we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated, we thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week, or $6 a month, or $50 for the year. It helps a lot, plus you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I like the idea that we have something we're meant to accomplish in this life, and that there is a, I think it's a healthy idea. It's a healthy thing for people to sort of take that kind of responsibility and feel encouraged to take responsibility for their own lives. At the same time, it's a fascinating conundrum when I think of the problems of this world and the challenge, the way in which a lot of people lose any sense of meaning, hope, direction, and purpose, which to me seems more common actually than people who have found their meaning and purpose. I don't know if you agree with that. I don't want to sound like a pessimist because I'm not really, I'm quite optimistic. Maybe even naive sometimes, as my friends like to remind me, but I don't know. I just maybe, and maybe it is because of that, that sense of having a reason for being here and having had it so young, whether I liked it or not, you know, that search for meaning in people's lives, I think is super important. And it's definitely one of the major motivating factors in my life to help, because you can recognize places you've been at, right? You can see it. And if you've been at wayward places, but you've had something that was able to carry you through them, then the gratitude that comes with that survival is something it's hard not to feel wanting to share that, projected outward, projection being the final stage of the alchemical process, of course, and that sharing, that sort of Rosicrucian ethos of sharing what you've learned with someone else so it can help them too. And that's a big thing.
Yeah, and especially those times, and this is what I think is so magical about the 12th place, 12th house in astrology, is because often it can describe those things which, when we're in them, it's like the worst possible thing. But afterwards, and like you said, if you get through them, then what you're left with is, I guess, a much stronger sense of like who you are and what you're here for. And that I don't think it's as simple as saying it's a certain job, or like you have to like save this kind of person or do this certain thing. I do think that destiny is broader than that, but it can be hard to kind of shake that idea that we actually have to be doing something as our like jobs that feels like destiny. I don't think that's what it is.
Yeah. I've noticed in my life's dharma that the spirits, the sense of what I'm meant to do with my life, while it can manifest through various forms in the world, if I don't do it in a responsible and healthy way, the spirits or my higher self or whatever you like finds a way for something just as good to come about, right? Like no matter how painful it is for me. So if I make a decision that takes me here or there and something else needs to happen, well, tough luck. I'm going to, you know, there's going to be some growing pains, is the nicest way to put it. Though sometimes, you know, calling it life-shattering trauma is another way.
Yeah. It's like, if you didn't get the message the nice way, the first time they left you the message, gave you the nudge. Yeah. You're just going to get it the life shattering trauma way later. That's also why I feel like there is, for me anyway, I felt like there was an urgency for me to try to wrap my head around the idea of the diamond. One of the things that happened when I was writing the book was, it was earlier in this year where I had like the bulk of my research done. I'd say I was like 80% there, and I was, you know, chipping away at the book and it was kind of coming along. And then as I was updating my computer, I lost basically everything. I still had like bits of research here and there. But I was left with that question of, you know, am I actually going to go for this? Am I actually going to write this book? Because if not, it's just been like mostly destroyed for me. And for me, that was a not a very kind, but a nudge from my diamond to just get on with it and make it happen. So those nudges, they're interesting, but I guess I'm grateful.
Yeah. So what was your journey to understanding your diamond through astrology, which is really the core praxis of the book, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it takes up a third of the book where I'm really going into the the astrological techniques, though I do end on a whole section where it's like, these are techniques that you could use without astrology. Yeah, for me, okay, astrology was just a way in for me to explore the concept. Then I ran, you know, some of the techniques on my chart. But I think the experiences that were most helpful for me was, so just putting this in context, this is 2019, and I, for some reason, got the urge to leave my flat and just basically quit my life in the UK for a year to see if there was anywhere else in the world I wanted to live. So I spent 2019 traveling, thankfully got that out of my system before 2020 happened. But I found that all of my goals that year, so it was everything from, you know, finding a new place to live, but also like figuring out what I wanted to do business-wise, because I wear a lot of different hats to do various things, but nothing was feeling that good at that time. And I hadn't actually started practicing astrology that much then. I was just kind of astro curious, I guess, at that time.
Curious.
Yeah.
That sounds like, yeah, a term on a dating profile, right?
Exactly. I sort of wish I hadn't said that now. But basically, it ended up being an intensely, like, it wasn't fun. I love travel. I mean, Sag Moon, I love to travel. I felt just incredibly lonely and just had a lot of experiences internally where I was like, this isn't right. I'm not where I want to be in my life. I also experienced some really profound anxiety that I'd never had before. Like, I'm a pretty like anxious person. Like, everyone has I think general anxiety most of the time, but I had my first like panic attack at an astrology conference. And in that time and the weeks that followed, whenever I got this feeling like bubbling up inside me, I started to kind of picture it as, I just tried to picture it as anything, you know, what does this feeling look like? And I started to see a little black and purple dragon. And to me, that I've started to understand that as the daimon in its like little beginning forms. It's always been there with me, but this is the first time it was like showing itself to me. And it was coming through this kind of sense of anxiety. And I won't just go into like a therapy session about this, but it was moments like that through difficult times that helped me make a lot of decisions over the course of the last couple of years. And ultimately it just, the whole experience, and this is also coinciding with a Saturn return, so I'll, you know, you can do with that what you will, but ultimately it feels like that process of working with the daimon, and I can share some of my other practices for doing that, has led to what I feel is much more so my path, which is practicing astrology and doing astrology readings. That's basically my full-time, well, close to full-time job right now. So that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, without my just, not just curiosity with the daimon, but also willingness to listen to it and do the, you know, do the crazy things that it says. Yeah, does that help?
You got any fun examples of a crazy diamond whispering that you felt you had to do, but even though it was crazy?
I think a lot of it was stopping. So my previous podcast and everything that I've been doing up until I guess last year ish was the creative introvert. So this is my business that I'd built up since like 2015 around helping creative introverts get their work out into the world, which is one of the first things that we were talking about here. It's like, I really don't want to do that marketing stuff anymore. And I don't want to spend all my time thinking about what is a pain-free way to market my work, because maybe there isn't one. It's possible that it's always going to be kind of painful for anyone who considers themselves to be a creative, and actually anyone, like most people don't like it.
Yeah.
So, and deciding to basically just go for it with astrology. I've been studying formally with Achyuta Bhava from Nightlight Astrology for the last couple of years. And, you know, combining that with just a hell of a lot of, you know, dedication to astrology. I mean, that was kind of weird coming to astrology and saying, I'm going to do this full time, when a few years prior, I was completely skeptical about it. That to me felt like the daimon told me to do that.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, definitely, yeah, a major life shift, and the Saturn return definitely can make sense. That I mean, a lot of people. So, Frater Acker, the German adept, associates his diamond, I believe, with Saturn. I haven't been able to read his book, Holy Diamond, because it's like $300 for the soft cover, because, you know, it's out of print. Or a lot of these limited print run things are creating books that people can't afford to get, which means we can't read the common literature that each other's reading, and therefore can't participate in conversations and dialogues of and learn from each other, because we can't find the common sources for a lot of the new books coming out, which I find is sort of the problematic downside of some of these new occult publishers and their publishing methods and the authors. Because it's like, well, if the book is so good and the ideas are so great, why do you not want everyone to hear them? Why do you only want 300 people ever, or 500 people, or 1,000 to ever hear them, and no one else can hear them? Because there's no PDFs. No one's going to take no one's going to take pictures of every page of a 300-page book. And that's all the copies there are. And it's done. And I understand the appeal of like exclusive fine editions, especially like who doesn't want to have exclusive fine editions and pay $300 for a leather bound? That's fine if you want to do that. But it would be nice if the information for some of these guys was actually accessible and not just for the few.
I totally agree. And one of the things with the diamond, which I was talking to, author the other day, Marja Daou, who's written a book called Familiars and Witchcraft, who obviously talks about the diamond. Her whole thing is, let's talk about this stuff. Like, it's really important for her, and it is for me, to actually have these conversations. I want to know like what other people's experiences have been with the diamond. And I as much as it's like a cool kind of sexy thing for this stuff to be hidden away and like, and literally occult, I don't see the point anymore. I think we've kind of moved beyond that. And yeah, definitely. Like I'm all for like nice, beautiful bound copies, but let's also have the digital versions available at least.
Least a soft cover. If you have to charge $60 for it, so be it, but it's better than not having it available. And maybe there are those copies of this book out there. I don't know. I'm just sort of complaining. but Frater Acker did associate it with Saturn in his workings. And a lot of people do. There's a good argument to be made that Saturn is a representative of the Holy Guardian Angel, or the Holy Angel that Agrippa talks about, especially in Saturn or Bina's relationship to Malchut and the kingdom and the bride of the Microprosopus. So those ideas are getting more popular again. And we're moving away from the sort of Abramelin Holy Guardian Angel language to a large extent. And one of the most interesting things that's come along is people arguing that the Holy Guardian Angel is, in fact, something you can only get in touch with through the Abramelin ritual, which, of course, seems a little odd to a lot of people. So then they say, wait a minute. And then others, and they respond, well, there's an angel that you get in touch with through this grimoire, and only through this grimoire. Mm-hmm. Right. And if you want to say that there's a specific spirit, that a certain spell or ritual, you know, especially an 18-month long ritual, gets you in touch with, I'm fine with that. It's like there's a certain kind of guide you get with this ritual that you don't get with another ritual. Sure, I can accept that. That sort of makes sense. I tend to have when it comes to things like reincarnation and the spirit realm, I tend to not have a very linear view of it. I tend to think it's going to be more complex than our current science can understand. And current science is more complex than I can understand. Therefore, I think none of us really have hit the nail on the head yet. And why can't we all have been Cleopatra in past lives? Maybe our souls that get reborn each life are somehow fusions of multiple souls or something. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we all share in the next realm. Maybe omniscience is an assumed taken for granted. And we all know all the lives that have lived. And that's just a natural state of that non-human consciousness that we don't even can't even imagine taking for granted as a preliminary baseline for the reality after life, after in this body, right? But maybe that's the case. I certainly think with spirits, they're not as limited as we tend to perceive them to be.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think I felt like, oh, I just have to park a lot of those ideas around Abramelin and these really elaborate rituals, which again, feel very like elitist in a way. Like I don't have a like mansion that I can go and practice this in. I don't have 18 months to take off work. But I do think that, like you said, if we just remember that, you know, Socrates didn't have to do some fucking crazy 18-month ritual to meet his daimon. And I'm not saying that, like, I've got the intuition of Socrates or the mind of Socrates, but it's like, I don't think the personal daimon, I think the personal daimon, for the reasons that I read in, like, Plato's concept of the daimon, let's say, the daimon has every desire to want to meet us. So I don't think it would require something so elaborate. And there's some weird like punishing, you know, and I definitely think if anyone has a daimon that relates to Saturn in any way, they probably will want to do some really elaborate ritual to find that daimon. Because that's almost in the daimon's nature, and the daimon will want that from you. I don't think so. I don't think that everyone has to go through that. And I do think it's just a matter of wanting it and showing up for it and saying, yes, I will get quiet and pay attention and reflect on what's going on and, you know, learn from, you know, these weird events that happen, weird synchronicities, losing most of my book while I was writing it on the daimon, you know? So I think it's really just a matter of consciousness shift, not a like eating raw eggs and at midnight. And it, though I'm all for rituals, I don't think it's necessary in this case for the personal daimon.
Yeah, I want to hear more about the raw egg midnight ritual. Well, I'm in. Tell me about this ritual.
Yeah.
Given the multiplicity of spirit guides and beings and spiritual creatures that a person can come into contact and the magicians often spend their time with, it does seem a little odd to me that we would place particular ones on pedestals and take, you know, generally we know spirits tend to like to lie or tell us what we want to hear, because they don't really understand our world too much. So they don't have the same, presumptions we do about certain things. And I always thought, if that's the case, why would we take these spirits' words as you know, solid advice, but then distrust these other spirits? And it makes me think that, again, all of these spirits together can be seen as guides for understanding our divine will. Because whether they're trying to keep us on our path or knock us off our path, they're still sort of there for our benefit, right? Like the Hebrew Bible's idea of Satan is as the adversary who's working with God. He works with God to gamble over Job's faith and life. I was hearing some fascinating new research coming out of some Dead Sea Scroll scholars that are giving new insight on the Job story, actually. Very interesting stuff. Okay. Yeah.
That sounds fascinating.
What do you think the point of having spirits that we put on pedestals is and take a lot of advice and guidance from, whether it's intuitive or explicit, versus just the multiplicity of spiritual creatures that we can interact with through different means?
Yeah. And this is, I really love that point. And I think something that you were saying earlier about how like your kind of like construct of like how things work, it's probably a lot more complicated than we think it is. And I personally I've heard so many different, like even the Neoplatonists themselves had different ideas about the structure of like the cosmos and the different hierarchies of daimons and heroes and all of that. And I'm just like, it's just some guy's way of trying to order things. And that's nice. But I can't help but think none of us know exactly how this looks. Okay. So that aside, same with the spirits. I don't think we know how that works. I like the idea that they're all on some level kind of like working for us. But ultimately, for me, the personal daimon, I think the simplest way of for me, grappling with it has been this idea that the Zoroastrian tradition had, religion had, which was you've kind of basically got like almost like a cartoon angel and a cartoon devil, and that you could see them as generally good spirits and generally bad spirits, but they're not personal. But then you've got the Fravashi, which is your kind of go-to guide for helping you steer between them, and that is like singularly the one that's kind of watching out for you and making sure that you are on your path. I think it's just
what
a question.
What was the word you said there?
Fravashi or Fravashi. Okay. Yeah.
New to me. Is that a Greek word?
Zoroastrian. This, whatever.
Hardcore.
Yeah. Well, this is the kind of, rabbit hole that I ended up going down with this. And it was just one of the first instances of a guiding spirit. So not just like a guardian look after you, but something that is actually helping steer your soul and not give in to the bad spirits, not give in to the good ones, but just kind of do you, basically. And to me, that's what the personal daimon is. Could you say, well, that's just your own, like, you know, is that your higher self? Is that just your own, like, divine mind, your own, like, mental, like, faculty or connection to the divine mind? Maybe. That's kind of the point of the book, was me sort of trying to explore those different possibilities.
Explore the issue of like the sort of I and thou, the complexity of that liminal barrier that may not be as real as it seems in this world.
I don't think it sounded like that when I wrote it. I don't think it sounded that clever, basically.
Oh, well.
But one of the, I do have a section on this possible like psychological dimension of it. And it was just a way for me to appease some of my skeptic friends who were like, you know, couldn't this be just your mind? And I was like, yeah, I guess it could. And here's, you know, some support for that. Here's also why I like to personify my daimon as a fox-headed fawn.
Well, I like that. I sort of am wishing my diamond was like a dragon now or something mythological and cool.
I could
trade up from an angel. Oh man, Edane McCoy back in the early 90s, one of my buddies, my Wiccan Coven, bought that dragon magic book by her, and I thought it was very hokey, but at the same time, I'm like, why not just work with dragon spirits? You can just do that. And because essentially the book seemed to just rename a bunch of Wiccan stuff with dragon names, like in a very simple way, like, you know, like a search and replace almost. But I also think, you know, yeah, I'm very into fairy spirits and elemental spirits and Enochian angels, and they all seem very similar to me in their behavior, especially the very chthonic and the ones that exist in that sort of middle realm between that manifest reality. And they seem very similar in their attitude and behavior to the little creator spirits in the DMT realms as well.
Yes. Yeah. And like even, like UFOs, that's not even what people call them anymore. But basically,
I just saw a video of some UFOs in Michigan just the other night. Some, you know, they're posting videos all the time, all over the place, and there are all these dots of light. I'm like looking at it, and it's a family video with little kids saying what's going on. And when they realize the adults don't know, they start to sort of freak out a little bit. And then you hear the adults feel like, Jesus Christ, like, look at it's just a bunch of these. It's not so like, and then they fade away sometimes. Are they coming from another dimension, or are they spirits manifesting in some sort of crazy vehicles? I don't know.
Well, and also this is something that I was grappling with this year, because I don't find it a stretch. And I think a lot of people now aren't finding it a stretch to be like, okay, something's going on in the sky that, you know, that isn't of this earth. Or we don't think, or maybe it is, but it's all like, you know, where is it coming from? Why are they camped in a different area than like talk of fairies and elemental beings? It's like, to me, they're all existing in the same reality, because I do think it's all a reality. A great book that kind of asks those questions and kind of posits that like everything's a daimon on some level, not a personal daimon, but a daimon. It's a book called Daimonic Reality by Patrick Harper. And that was really like, it's just a fun romp through all different kinds of like weird phenomena. And saying like, you know, the kind of fairy reality isn't so different from the UFO reality. We've just kind of like, we just imagine different things. Like culture has taught us that a UFO film wouldn't have little cute fairies in it, or even malevolent fairies. It's just like we've kept those genres separate. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're not separate. It's the argument.
Yeah, no, it's to me, this is a very fascinating point, actually. I mean, the way that we use scientism to parse and separate things that really seem like they should be considered together in a serious way. I mean, we're starting to make progress. You see that in the realm of psychedelics and entheogens and ritual and many people, of course, have leapt into the alien space from there and seen those two as one and the same thing for a long time. Mm-hmm. But only recently did we have, you know, the mighty U.S. government come out and declare to us poor plebs in Canada and in Britain, I guess now, mm-hmm. that they don't actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So whether we believe them or not, mm-hmm. I think it's likely that they don't know what's going on. At this point, which is fascinating. It makes me think of the placebo effect. I was talking with a friend over dinner last night. I was talking about some of the work that Solomonic and other grimoire magicians are doing on healing people with serious diseases. And my friend, of course, being a technical scientific person, she said, yeah, but how can you tell the difference between that and just the people who seem suddenly do recover from cancer or stuff like that, which is a percentage of people. So how do you know you're not just correlating that? Plus the placebo effect, that's a real thing. It's like 51%. And it's just a way that we recover from things because we think we should. I'm like, that's magic.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, it's the placebo effect. That is a scientism name that's been used to label. It's like, oh, there's something about human beings that allows us to heal extremely well and just from us thinking that we should be healed, from being convinced that we took the right pill or did the right spell or you know, stopped smoking or whatever, and therefore we should be well, and so we get a lot better. And the appropriation of that by science under the term placebo effect to me seems like a heresy. It's like, okay, so for all of history, people have been doing healing and found that it really was effective. And now you're saying, no, that is just a process that naturally occurs through human beings that science doesn't understand. And its name is the placebo effect. It's ours now. And you can't use it anymore.
Like and what you're describing is magical. And putting it under the science category, it's like, well, now you're changing science.
Yeah,
like they're just changing science. And it's like, okay, if you want science to be a religion or like just as magical as you think our stuff is, go for it. It's I know what you mean.
By all means, equivocate terms as loosely as us New Agers. Right. Now we're all in the same nutty boat. Well, that's an interesting thing, actually, when science becomes the gatekeeper to spirituality. Because mm-hmm. It's already the gatekeeper of truth. Mm-hmm. And if it wants to gatekeep spirituality by creating terms for things that it defines as not understanding, yeah, we're in a strange landscape these days. Although, of course, we don't have to. I just realized that the very nature of this topic is so on the, you know, tips of everyone's tongues these days, mm-hmm. with the global crisis, right? So the issues of questioning science is so hot. It's a little frightening. I mean, even when you have scientists contradicting themselves one day to another, and you're like, wait, are you literally making this up as you go along, or being persuaded to say what you're saying because of politics or money or power or what totalitarians or whatever it is?
And like science from all angles kind of being taboo. Like I was watching a Russell Brand video earlier today about this guy. I think he was like the CEO of a company, Sweetgreens, which maybe you know of. It's not in the UK. Saying how, we should put like a ban on sugar and stuff because so many of the really bad COVID cases are related to people being like obese and stuff. And now he's been kind of like shamed. or like, so he's been like told off for like fat shaming, basically. But the question is, like, we can't look at science now. We can't, because we might offend someone. So it's an interesting.
Yeah, here, I mean, here we have they're calling to not admit fat people to the hospital anymore. That's what they're calling for, and to not treat them for COVID if they get it, because they don't deserve it because they're fat. We also have like Rutgers University, which you've probably heard of, right? They've extended their vaccine mandate to not only cover students who come to classes, but also Zoom students. So if you're not vaccinated and you've just paid your tuition to Rutgers, you can't attend Zoom classes because you're not vaccinated.
Well,
science, it does.
It's a confusing time. I thought the Neoplatonists were confusing me, but I think just the world today is.
Oh, I love that. I love that modern science has gotten to the point where Neoplatonism might make more sense.
I really enjoy this chat. It's getting late over here, so I probably go to bed.
Well, tell people a little bit about all your places and where to find you, and maybe any last advice you have for their astrological search for their personal diamond.
Yes, absolutely. So you can find me at catroseastrology.com, and that's where all my stuff is. And there'll be a link to the Kickstarter, so you could support the book if you choose to do that. In terms of the astrology, I definitely think looking at, if you have your birth chart, definitely look at the 11th house and the 12th house in your charts. And like I said, reflect on some of those experiences. People in your life who have, you know, you've had positive experiences with, even the negative ones. And you might be able to spot some patterns in there. And that will basically show you a little bit more about the path that your diamond is nudging you on. I go into this in the book. I go into 3 other astrology techniques as well. So
if you want more people, buy the book.
Sorry. I feel like we've just been talking about leaders, and I wish I had more time to go into.
No, that's perfect. Yeah. That's great. I think I have a very clear idea about what the book is about now. And I know you sent me a link so I could check it out, but I tend to like my podcast. I find the most fun podcasts are the more exploratory ones, mm-hmm. where the person tells me about it. Because if you can get me interested in what you've done, then other people will probably be interested in what you've done. I think it is very interesting. I'm very curious to see the kind of map you've laid out using a bit of Hellenistic astrology and mm-hmm. a variety of things, it sounds like, to suss this out, because it's an interesting question, especially between the theories and the experience. I think we have a lot more to say on that. And that's why I'm really glad you had a chance to come on the Arnomancy podcast with me, Reverend Eric.
Yeah. thanks for calling me up on that. go on, tell them.
So you got me confused with my buddy Reverend Eric down in Portland.
What happens when you're sending far too many emails in one day, and I apologize for that.
I only made you wait a week to respond as punishment.
Very graciously, thank you.
No, it's cool. I'm very glad you did find me. And are you going to do Eric's podcast?
I am. Yeah. So awesome. That's coming up. I didn't call him Fraser Rossi, so maybe that's that was the mutual.
He's a fun guy. I really like him. I hope the border opens up so I can go visit Portland and Seattle soon. Yeah. See all my homies there. Yeah. Kat, thank you so much. It's really great to talk to England and Brighton. I've always wanted to visit Brighton because it's on the beach, right?
Yeah. And it's fun. We have some it's a little bit more new agey than the rest of England, other than Glastonbury.
Yeah. There's a few authors who live there and near there that I've always wanted to visit. And maybe I'll get a chance to when I get back to Rochester and pick up my luggage there. Hopefully I'll see you in England one day, my friend.
Yeah, likewise.
All right. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Take care.
Peace. Bye.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a six-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.